Drummer Psalm is sponsored by Supernova Drum Company. Bespoke drums made with unique shell combinations using many different species of wood. Supernova Drum Company, truly custom drums. Visit supernovadrums.com and facebook.com/supernovadrumco for more details.
There is an inexorable force in the cosmos where time and space converge. A place beyond man's vision, but not his reach. It is the most mysterious and awesome point in the universe.
Unbearable suspense and sadistic terror grip the senses as these human beings threaten the safety of a city.
My daughter has invaded our planet. Washington, Franklin, Harris, Moscow, Arquitas. The whole world is under attack.
Hold on to your chairs, folks, for here they are.
Give the drummer some.
Take that crazy rhythm.
It's nice to be back in that old groove again, Daddy. 14 mounted toms, 8 floor toms, 4 splashes, 2 gongs, 10 cowbells, 4 rides, 5 snares, man. A roto-tom rack.
And it's all mounted on my infamous quadruple kick drum system.
Hey! Did you touch my drum set?
Hey, knock it off!
Good evening, friend.
And welcome to Give the Drummer Some podcast. World-class drummers, we know them as the masters of keeping time, but what really makes them tick? Not only will we be talking to all your favourite drummers about their amazing careers, we'll also be attempting to find out more about them, such as their favourite films, activities, and what drives them in their lives. So guys, I've got a great episode for you today, because I spoke to a friend of mine, called Austin Lane, who is the drum department manager at Absolute Music down in the south coast of the UK. And you know what? I always love talking to friends of mine on the podcast, because you know them as a friend, you know them as a mate, but then you really find out their main story whilst you're talking to them in this kind of a setting. And Austin has a great story. He was in a band, and still is in a band, called Seven. They released 2 singles back in the late 80s, early 90s, but they never got to complete their album and release their album. Well, the great news is they released their album less than a week ago, and it's really good. It's kind of an AOR kind of rock album. It's just a really, really nice album, and it's just great that they have completed it after all this time, 20 years in the making. So I thoroughly recommend that you go to Amazon or iTunes or any reputable music stores and you purchase the number 7 by the band 7. Or alternatively, if you want to go onto our website at gtdspod.com, on Austin's episode at the bottom, you'll see a link that takes you to the album on Amazon. And yeah, just download away. So on this episode, we talk, well, of course, about his past, his present and his future, and just about what the music business was like back in the day, and just all the lovely stories that Austin has to offer. So guys, once again, I hope you really enjoy it. So we're going to be starting off the episode with part of a track called Don't Break My Heart, which is available on the album 7x7. And then we're going to play a full track at the very end, once again, on the same album. And that is called America. So make sure you listen out for that. It's a bit good, yeah? So if you want to find out a little bit more about 7, then make a beeline over to Facebook. And in the search bar just at the top, type in 7 fan page. And it will take you to the right destination. And make sure, please, you hit that like button at the top.
I never gave up on you. Oh no. But I still have my pride. Time's on my side. I know I'll get through it. Don't break my heart. No, you won't see me crying.
Baby.
Don't break my heart.
Austin, man, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Right. Well, the very first and most important question. Has my bit of DW hardware come in yet?
I believe it's on a slow boat from China, Chris, actually.
Oh, right. No, okay, cool.
I will have a check, mate. I've been on a... I've taken a week off just to enjoy the sunshine. So DW hardware for Mr. Troy has been kind of not the front of my mind this week.
All right.
Should be, but it's not.
That's no worries. That's no problems. So yesterday was a really, really big day for you because Seven released your first album.
Yes, I've been 23 years in the making.
That's longer than Guns N' Roses do an album.
To be fair, we didn't spend the whole time in the studio. We went off and had children and stuff like that and did all sorts of normal things. It's the most surreal thing ever, Chris. It's back in the day, we did a couple of singles for Polydor and we did a lot of tours with Brother Beyond and Richard Marx, The Monkees, Jason Donovan. And we were kind of tipped to be, one of the next big things of the day back then.
Right.
Everything was kind of going right, but we had not internal fallouts with the band, but record companies and management and, all the usual sort of stuff with politics of records that has nothing to do with actually making music. And it kind of just, we did everything we could. It kind of ran its course. As a band, we never actually kind of fell out. We just couldn't do any more. There was things holding us legally. There was loads of different aspects. And we were tired. We'd spent a long time and a lot of time on the road and just away trying to make it work. And it kind of just ran its course.
Yeah.
And ran out of money. I had to get a job, had to work, like most people.
Yeah.
And then I went into selling drums. And then kept playing, obviously, demoing stuff, worked at Paul Percussion for quite a few years, and then three and a half years ago, moved over to set up the drum department at Absolute Music, which is a plug, a massive superstore in the UK, guys.
Incredible superstore.
Indeed, and supplier of DW hardware to Mr. Chris when they come. And and then Pat, the bass player from Seven, was recording an album with a great singer called Robert Hart up in Manchester. And the guy that owned Escape Music is a guy called Cahill Turk. And he just was talking to Pat and stuff. And it just so happened that he actually loved Seven and what we'd done and couldn't believe that the album had never been made.
Right.
So he kind of said to Pat, is everyone still around and are they up for making an album? And, of course, we are, and we were. So it just kind of escalated from there, and him and his team were just amazing and just ran with it. And we were kind of all a little bit, I guess, jaded and cynical. And we were like, yeah, whatever, carry on. And he just did. And he got this producer in from Sweden, a guy called Lars Chris. He's done an outstanding job of, I think, of making us sound like not guys from 1980s. He's taken the stuff and reworked a lot of it, and we've re-recorded it all. And of course, the big thing for I guess all of us was whether Mick could still sing, because the stuff we do is obviously very taxing vocally.
Yeah.
Mick for the last 20 years has just sung in the shower.
Right.
And of course, but luckily, and I'd never say this to his face, but Mick's singing better than ever. It's great. And we're just looking forward really to seeing how the album does. A lot of things depend on that. From there, we'll take it on the road. We're all ready to go. Keith and Simon are in South Africa. They're raring to go. Pat, Nick, myself, everyone is just really gearing up to getting back. We were always a great band live. We were always better live than we were on record.
Right.
I think this new album, our only album, goes a long way to capturing more what we're about. It's a lot rockier than the stuff this was one of the problems in the early days.
Yeah.
Because of kind of how we looked for whatever reason. We, the record company, kind of geared us towards a teen market.
Right.
And we were kind of playing this sort of AOR rock music.
Right.
So the two were very difficult to get into a pigeonhole as record companies and whatever like to do. So we were kind of playing, you know, sort of Journey, Toto, Foreigner type, that sort of genre of music. And we were being marketed to, you know, we were doing interviews in Just 17, Jackie and My Guy.
Oh, God.
And they were photographing us with lots of makeup, which we probably needed, to be fair. But no, it was so it was this sort of catch-22 thing. I mean, we were just pleased, in all fairness, to get a record out. You know, we were signed to Polydor for a couple of singles, and we were young guys and just happy to get a record. And I have to say, the appeal of playing to 15,000 screaming girls was a little bit better than playing to a load of hairy ass bikers, to be honest.
Yeah,
it's just great to get this record out. And it's a very special time for the five of us.
Yeah,
it's kind of conclusion. It's what we set out to do 20 odd years ago, and we finally done it. So we can, like, say, well, this is it. This is Seven, like it or not.
Yeah.
This is what we do. Here we go. Here it is. And I have to say, everyone's playing great on it, and it's just great. And we're just all totally made up, totally surreal. Can't believe after all this time, a dream's finally been realised, and feel very fortunate that we've had the opportunity to do this. And yeah, what can I say? Just please buy it, please.
Please buy it. But no, I mean, seriously, it's a really good album, because I checked out the I think there's a teaser, or there was a teaser at the time. I think it was on Amazon.
Yeah.
And because I was expecting, I mean, I previously, after sort of chatting to you and you sort of saying you used to be in a band called Seven, and, you know, I checked out Man with a Vision, I think it was, the video. Yeah. And it was, I mean, there were sort of AOR elements to it, but you could see that it was kind of more the pop end. But then the new album that you guys have just released now, it really is kind of Journey like, and, you know, there is a rockier vibe to it.
Well, this is kind of where we always were.
Right.
But, this is what we were doing back then.
This is what the band was doing, but then the record company was kind of saying, no, we've set you up with, you know, Just 17 and all that sort of thing. Was that kind of how it played out?
Basically, yeah. I mean, you know, we kind of lost control, which hindsight's always easy, isn't it? But
yeah.
As I say, we were just grateful to get a record out. And however that came about, you know, looking back now, okay, we should have maybe said, yeah, yes, no, and not. But, you know, we didn't. So, and this, as I say, this is conclusion for us. This is the album we should have made 23 years ago. So,
yeah.
And maybe had we would have done it, would have been a different story. But I don't care. We've done it. And this is really, as I say, it's conclusion. It's what happens from here is just really icing on the cake. You know, if we take it out on the road, if we go to different countries and play it, then great. If we do a second album, fantastic.
Yeah.
But this is kind of this is tick the box for us.
That's fantastic. It's like a conclusion, but it's also a new start. It's kind of
very much so. And as I say, you know, everyone's up for it. Everyone's playing. We've all kept playing. I mean, Keith took a couple of years out, and his daughter got to like grade 8 on guitar IKEA, and Keith was a bit put out, I think. So he kind of got his guitar out and started showing her how to do it. So and Mick's son is Josh is the drummer for One Direction, and Josh is a fantastic drummer, great little player, and I'd like to say I had anything to do with it, but other than getting him his first drum kit, I can take no thanks at all for that. He's just a lovely guy and a great drummer, and it kind of does grate on me sometimes when you get, I mean, I'm not One Direction's biggest fan. I'm not going to go and buy their album.
Yeah.
No more than I'm going to go and buy Megadeth's album, Napalm Death's album.
You haven't got Napalm Death's album?
No, well, kind of, it's not on the, I, no, something. And, but I have great respect for all of them because in their particular genres, they do it very well.
Yeah.
Now, whether you like One Direction or not, they are the most successful band in the entire universe. Yeah. And, you know, they get knocked to hell. But let me tell you, that band behind them, Josh and his mates playing, they are great, great players.
Right.
Josh is a fantastic drummer. And, you know, just listen to the band. You know, if you don't want to listen to the five guys singing, whatever they do. But Josh is a great drummer. And we've always talked about doing something together, me and him. And I would need to practice for about 6 months, 24/7, just to hang on to his coattails. He is a demon and a lovely guy. That's my little plug for One Direction. I'm sure they don't need my help.
That's great. Perhaps they'll take you guys on tour with them next time. That'd be pretty cool.
I don't think we'll be the best match, mate. I think we'd be called Old Direction.
Yeah. Wrong direction.
Yeah, no direction. Or yeah, non-directed or something, I don't know. But no, yeah, so that's my little plug for Josh, and he's great.
Cool. Well, you guys formed in 89. I'd like to maybe talk about the kit that you used back then, because, I mean, back then in those days, you know, we're talking what, the rack toms were like 12 by 12, 14 by 14 racks. Did you sort of have that kit?
And then to the trap, I always stuck with toms. A couple of little folk play, but I never went for the square tom. The deepest I ever went was 12/10.
Right.
Normally, back then, most of the stuff was recorded on a Yamaha 9000.
Yeah.
Then it went to a Pearl BLX. And again, you know, one of the great achievements, well, proudest moments for me was getting an endorsement deal with Pearl. And a gentleman called George Frederick, who we've remained great friends ever since, was working for Pearl at the time. And he contacted us. We did a Disney Club TV show. And my drum tech at the time, we had a Yamaha kit on there. No, Pearl kit was provided, and he blacked the name out because I was playing the Yamahas and I had some sort of trade deal with Yamaha.
Right.
And he contacted us. And at the time, not because I was any great player or anything under that, I could have had anyone's drums because we were doing a lot of television and a lot of exposure. So George was just such a lovely guy, and I went with George and we did it all on the handshake, and 25 years later we're still friends, so it must have been quite a good handshake.
Yeah, cool.
Again, Zildjian, and stayed with them all the way through. Been great. I did have a tiny little affair with a different symbol company, but I soon went back to Zildjian. But the thing with endorsements, and I think this is very important for young guys coming up, and, you know, it's everyone's dream, and it was my dream, and luckily I realised it. But people go chasing endorsements, and I speak to a lot of the guys now in my job nowadays, and you'll get people that will go to a drum company and say, well, look, I tried Yamaha, Pearl, Tama and everyone else, and they won't give me anything, but maybe you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're ready for someone to endorse you, or whichever way you look at it, endorse a product, they will come to you, because you have to have something to give the company.
Yeah.
You know, now I did a couple of clinics on a low-key basis for Pearl. Now, I'm not really, you know, that sort of chops guy to do that sort of thing. But, I mean, I guess I just about had enough to bluff my way through it. And a lot of, I want to do some more clinics in the future if this does anything. There's a million guys that are going to play a million times faster, a million times better than I can. But it's just sometimes insight into the industry. And that's not to say I know everything, but I've seen a lot of different aspects about it.
Yeah.
You know, from the sort of, so I played with bands back in the many moons ago when I was signed to EMI. That went wrong. Obviously played with Seven, we toured a lot. I've seen a lot of different aspects and from the retail side. And I've also made some very good friends, both in the playing field and in the sort of retail field. And I mean, by good friends, I mean, you know, guys like Phil Gould, Jeremy Stacey, Gavin Harrison, Steve White, they're all really good friends. And that sort of relationships that you build up, a lot of it's out of trust and mutual respect. And, you know, Phil Gould's a really close friend and a lovely guy. And Gavin and I have become, you know, good friends. And we trust, you know, Gavin, people like that, they trust you. And if they need something, whatever, they will, you know, they know, hopefully, that I'm not going to let them down. And Steve's come down and done a lot of stuff with me, you know, teaching wise and stuff. And they're just really nice, genuine people. And I think generally most drummers are.
Yeah.
And the other thing in Dorset, and you know, Dorset is a very small community, kind of like where you live, Chris. You know, obviously you're an island, but we're kind of isolated.
Yeah.
And it's a very strong community, and I really like that drum community. And I really work very hard at trying to sort of gel it and make it come together. You know, so we do a lot of clinics, we do a lot of events, we do masterclasses. I work closely with people like Mike Dolbear, who brings like Thomas Lang down, because Absolute Music has fantastic facilities. We have a live PA demonstration room that we can hold clinics in. Obviously, the sound's great because you've got a live PA demonstration room.
Yeah.
We've got a restaurant or a cafe. The girls will be very pleased I called it a restaurant. And we've got a recording studios, we've got rehearsal rooms, so we can accommodate anything. So if Thomas Lang wants to come and have a room for 30 students, we can do that. Mm. Of course, you know, that's, Bournemouth is close to train stations, aircraft, planes, whatever, you know. So it's got all the facilities. And there's obviously Bournemouth, there's plenty of hotels, there's no shortage of people, places for people to stay.
Yeah.
So in the guys, you know, their own Absolute, they've made a conscious effort to make it a sort of destination go-to place.
Yeah.
And it's worked out very well. But back to the endorsement thing, you know, when you're ready, people will come to you. And as I say, you have to have something to offer.
Yeah.
And that will be in terms of tour schedules. It's no good thinking that playing down the Dog and Duck to five mates, anyone's going to give you a drum kit. You know, you need to have TV, you need to have a profile, and also you need to, you know, a lot of it is just getting on with people as well.
Yeah.
Because it's no good someone giving you a drum kit and then you're such high maintenance that, you know, you take up their whole life. And like with George at Pearl, and I have no illusions where we sat on the ladder of things and where I sat, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we were sort of the arse end of it. You know, so we were support band level, but at that level, I probably needed support more than someone like, you know, Steve Gadd or someone would, because Steve's got everything on a plate, whereas, you know, we were kind of starving. And if something broke, I needed replacements. And George never made me feel any less than Dave Weckl. Whenever I spoke to George, it was like, you know, George, I need some snare wires, I need some hi-hat clutches, I need some whatever. And it was always there. It was either at the venue or at the hotel room. And it was just, and as I say, he always made me feel, you know, like as if I was some sort of super duper drummer, which obviously I wasn't and still isn't. But it never made me feel that way. Always made me feel incredibly important and a gentleman, and still going strong now. As he says, ducking and diving. So.
So I've read in Wikipedia that you guys attracted the attention of Philip Schofield, the Silver Fox.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Mr. Schofield wasn't quite as silver then. But no, Phil was very instrumental in us getting signed to Polydor, because he was plugging our stuff on Radio 1 and loved the demos.
Right.
And one thing our management always did was we had some very, very high-quality demos. I mean, we were, like, recording at Rockfield and places like that. So it was always broadcastable quality. It wasn't, like, done on some old, you know, C90 cassette or something. It was always high quality. And, of course, he was getting pressure from people, and Polydor signed us. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history.
Right.
We did the two singles with Polydor, and they both made top 100, but that was as good as it got.
So have you spoken to him recently or tried to get in contact with him again just to say we're here and we've done an album and all that, or
no?
Would you guys not think about sort of perhaps on Twitter? Yeah, he's always on Twitter.
The album's just come out, so it's early days. So yes, I mean, obviously, hopefully he will like what we're doing now, and maybe, you know, maybe we'll rekindle old friendships and stuff.
Oh, cool.
There's a lot of things in the pipeline, and it really does all depend on, you know, how this goes.
Yeah.
It's had great reviews all around Europe, all around everywhere. It's being released in Japan next weekend with a bonus track. However, none of us are actually going to Japan, which is kind of a shame, but no. Everything really hinges on how this does from now on in. Mick's done a lot of interviews, various places, but all the reviews are fantastic. We've had great reviews from everywhere, Germany, Italy, Greece, all around Europe, Denmark, Sweden, great, great reviews. No one's yet sort of slanted off. So everything is, I've just realised I say I'm a lot, don't I?
You're all, I do as well. I won't worry about it.
I've just realised that. So I'm just going to say a lot of ums now. I'm going to stop saying ." I'm going to stop saying ."
Hey, you're all right. It's cool. It's cool. I'll just edit it out. I'll just spend like 4 days doing it. Don't worry about it.
So no more ums. Where was I? Yes, what was I talking about? Oh, yes, yeah, so it really depends where it all goes. All the reviews are great. Everything's sort of ticking the right boxes. So it's just seeing how it goes. We're kind of old enough and cynical enough not to get too excited, but inside we're just burning up, ready to go. You know, it's just absolutely... The Vic Firths are there twitching in my hand, mate, twitching, ready to go.
Yeah. It would almost make a great movie. You know what I mean? That kind of full Monty kind of vibe. I mean, hopefully you guys won't ever take your clothes off in general public, but you know what I mean?
There is no censorship board in the world that would pass that, Chris. Not one. Nowhere in
Not
the
Not at all. It would scare everyone.
It would be, well, I'm not going there.
It would scar them for life.
They would be, actually, probably they could use it as like a kind of variation on germ warfare, I think, you know. He's suffering in the nude.
It would, it would be more censored than the human centipede.
I believe, mate, it would be. And it would be a very strange centipede as well.
Tell me. Who would play you in this movie?
Oh, I'd have to play myself, mate. I couldn't let anyone else do it. If Brad Pitt was available, I guess I could let him have a crack.
Brad Pitt. See, I was thinking more Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, thanks, mate. I was thinking more Brad Pitt here.
Brad Pitt as the early Austin Lane, and then yourself as the later on Austin Lane.
There we go. Yes. Yeah, enough makeup in a big corset, I could probably get away with the young one, you know. we could try that.
Special effects, maybe. It's a bit of CGI.
But it's pretty good what they could do with Photoshop.
Yeah.
There must be a film version of it, like Filmoshop or something.
But, I mean, see, what you guys are doing is exactly what, I mean, we didn't get the level of success that you got. I mean, we didn't really have any success at all, really. We just were sort of playing over here and stuff. But my old band, we were called Eskimo with a Q. We got to a point where we had a load of songs ready to go, and we were going to do an album and just sort of see how it went. And then it never got recorded. And then a few years ago, we sort of got together, started on a track, and then it never finished. And I kind of know, I mean, your feeling to do this, your sense to do this must have been 100 times what mine is, because you were actually out there doing it, you know, to finish a project that you wanted to do, you know. And it's just it's just really encouraging. And I think it's great for, you know, hearing your story for so many people in their bands that never quite got to completing something, to finally complete it, I think it's a fantastic thing.
It's an absolute dream come true, Chris, and I can't put it into words. I don't have enough intellect or vocabulary, whatever, say emotionally for all of us. I think it's just been immense. I mean, it's an absolute dream come true.
Yeah.
And I'm still that 13-year-old boy that was wanting to make a record and play Hammersmith Odeon. Now, I made 3 records. I've now done the album, and I played Hammersmith 13 times.
Right.
I've been very fortunate in that, and I've been incredibly fortunate where I've managed to make my living all of my life out of playing drums. There's been a couple of little hiccups when I've had to work. When I say work, I mean, obviously I work now, but work in a non-musical environment.
Right.
Literally just to pay bills and feed people. But for 99% of it, it's always been drum-related. That's either playing them, teaching them, or selling them. As you know, I was quite actively involved with a lot of vintage stuff, and I've kind of taken a bit of a back seat on that, but I still have a vast interest in, you know, like Ludwigs and Rogers and Camcos, whatever. And I've just been very, very lucky. And there's a lot of my friends in England and all around, well, like yourself, used to, Chris, make a, when you were teaching.
Yeah.
You know, guys I've known make a living out of drumming. They might not be Chad Smith, they might not be in the Chili Peppers, but they're making a living, they're feeding their families.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great achievement.
Yeah.
If you're doing something or involved in something you love.
Yeah.
And, you know, to any, I hate to use the term kids because it's so patronizing, but to any younger people, and most people are younger than me, Chris, but any younger people out there, you know, if you can, you don't have to be the biggest rock star in the universe to be successful.
Yeah.
And, you know, by success, you know, I mean, you know, feeding people, you know, and working hard and being, just be honest to yourself. You know, I've always been honest to myself.
Yeah.
You know, there's paths that look, that could be a lot easier, but that isn't necessarily the one to take. You know, you just got to be true to yourself so that I can look back now. Now, I'm 25 now, I think. 25 and a bit, I think.
Right.
And I can look back over those years and say, I've been honest to myself. I've got no regrets. Whether things didn't pan out how I wanted them to first time around or second time, whatever, I've no regrets.
Yeah.
I was always true to myself, always followed what I thought I should do. And I remember when I joined Seven, they were called Face to Face back then. My girlfriend at the time, we went to Spain, and I was in a band called Dancing English, and we signed to EMI, did a single called Feel It. It was produced by a guy called Chris Neal, and we recorded it at Air Studios. It was all, you know, going great. We got dropped by EMI. Things were kind of sticky. And Face to Face kind of asked me, they used to support Dance English, and they kind of asked me to come and drum with them. And there was a song called Charlie, and it was a rock ballad. And to this day, it's just such a brilliant song. And Keith and Simon wrote it. And it's the one song that really convinced me to kind of leave a band that was, had a record deal, just lost it, but was still kind of there-ish.
Yeah.
To go with a band that was trying to do it. And that was quite a big decision. And one I took in at the time, face to face, that became seven, weren't signed. You know, we literally went off. I joined them a couple of months later. We were on tour supporting Brother Beyond.
Right.
And we could, kind of did that on our own back. And we used to, you know, it's all back to paying your dues, which I think a lot of bands don't necessarily do. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But at the time, I had some friends that were, I had to do some work because obviously there was no income. Mm. And I was selling car accessories to garage forecourts. And a lot of the guys that were working in the forecourts were giving me these various petrol stations, Esso, Shell, whatever, used to do these vouchers. You know, for like if you bought £10 worth of petrol, you get a voucher.
Yeah.
And you used to be able to go and get a breakfast from Burger King. And these people used to give me like wads of these vouchers. And we were literally, that's how we funded the first tour, was we were going in and getting breakfast in Burger King with these vouchers. Because we had no money. You know, we literally were just doing it. Management were putting in what they could. But it was, you know, it was. I mean, it was great though. I mean, you know, I'm not making it out to be like any different. It was great.
Yeah.
But, you know, but we were proper full on skins, and we got very good at scrounging drinks and going to parties and spending no money. We got very good at that. But yeah, and that's a skill that's actually stayed with some of them actually, if I think about it. No, but it was great fun. I mean, it was fantastic days, great fun. But we really were like slapping it up and down, you know, in the transit van, Spinal Tap fashion. It was great, and it was good fun. But you know, it was. I think a lot of people in bands miss that. They don't get that now. I mean, the great thing with the internet is obviously it's very easy for people to get their music out there. The bad thing is there's a million people getting their music out there.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword. But it's, you know, to get yourself heard now in some of the software. I mean, you know, that not once recording this new album were the five of us in the same room together at one time.
Oh, right.
It was all done, zip-filed, around the world, all to Sweden, and it was all done like that. You know, two of the guys are still in South Africa. Yeah. So then the video was done in Italy, I believe. And it's just one of the word videos, but it's great. They've done a fantastic job. But as I say, this is all down to Cahill at Escape Music, who's really taken it, and his love of what we did and his love of music in general is really sort of run with this. He's the one that's taken it up. I mean, we've just kind of gone along for the ride, really.
Yeah.
Mick recorded all his vocals at... Josh, his son, so he's got his, they've got a home studio, so that was all done there. So yeah, it's just been done all over the place.
I mean, the when you listen to the album, I mean, it's really surprising that it was done in all different places because it sounds so what's the word, cohesive.
Well, I have to say that's totally down to Lars Chris in Sweden. That's nothing to do with us, mate. That's just all down to him. He's made some, I think, done a good job of making us sound modern.
Yeah.
Well, as modern as we're going to sound. I mean, obviously that genre of music is, you know, we're never going to be the cutting edge. We're never going to be, you know, music's great big new thing. But, you know, I think it sounds contemporary in the style of the genre of music that it is.
Yeah.
And you know, as you say, I mean, I'm glad you like it. We're very pleased with it. And it's just a statement. It's a statement that this is us, and like it or not, then, you know, we've done it. And that's it.
That's great. So what about the record labels? What were your experiences with those guys back in the day, and what have you learnt from those experiences to sort of help you guys now?
Well, we had very little dealings with them back in the day because obviously we had management,
right?
And now it's just Cahill's just really just gone with it, so we're just kind of going with it. Everything he's said, he's done. So we have no reason to. He's been absolutely amazing, to be honest.
Cool.
So, you know, as I say, I guess a little bit negative towards him in the past because only because of what was fed back to us from various sources. But, you know, now it's every single thing that he's promised has come up. And the guy, for us, he's a dream maker. You know, so it's great, fantastic.
Absolutely great. Because, I mean, I spoke to another friend of mine, a guy called Dave Neal, and he was one of the very early episodes of Give the Drummer Some, and he was in a rock band called Rooster in the early noughties, I believe. And literally they just weren't flavour of the month, and they were getting ready to do their second album. And they got called into the record company executive's office, and he said, "Yeah, my daughter doesn't listen to you guys anymore, so that's it. Thank you very much, and see you later." And I mean, Dave went from, you know, recording in the same studio as Nirvana and staying in LA and all that. Literally within a week, I think he said, he was back at home with his parents. So, I mean, did you have a similar sort of situation to that? Did that happen as well?
Not really, because we did the two records. We did the two singles, which is what we were kind of contracted for.
Right.
And then we could have done an album, but various reasons it never materialised. I really don't know the reasons for that, Chris. And then three of us carried on and signed with a company called FM Revolver, and we decided to call ourselves Glory Days and did a single called Picture Yourself. And that, I think, sold 24 copies, maybe 25. No, but it didn't happen. I mean, that was Keith, Simon and myself. Nick and Pat, it's kind of called it a day by then. And it was Mick. I mean, it's got great songs, and it's not a bad single.
Yeah.
Not a bad little EP, four tracks on there, but it didn't happen, and that kind of fizzled out. I think FM Revolver had a lot of financial problems at the time, so then we were kind of left high and dry again. I mean, I've signed to EMI, Polydor, FM, so record company, getting the record deal was never a problem, it was doing something with it is always the problem.
Right, I've got you.
So, I mean, I think record companies are like any, you know, at the end of the day, it's an old cliche. It's the word music business. It is a business.
Yeah.
And you have to view it like that. And, you know, I think if you go in with the view that you're going to get shafted, then you won't be disappointed. And I think there's very few, very, very few people that would ever say that they kind of got everything they should have got. And that goes on today, you know.
Yeah.
Carries on, and that's, you know, however big or small you are within, you know, even if you take it down to playing in a pub, you know, we'll give you 100 quid, then you get your money, and it's suddenly it's 70 because right. There wasn't enough people in, or you know,
yeah,
there the barman left or whatever, you know, it's no different. I don't think it's just on a lot bigger scale.
Right.
So I think you know. Playing music for you know, to try and make a load of money is, unless you're very fortunate, it's never going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the very, very famous musicians, you know, they sort of also have their finger in other pies, and they have incredibly good accountants as well.
That's very true. I mean, you'll be amazed how little some of these people make out of the actual, you know, the art of drumming.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I mean, as I say, I've got some very good friends who have got successful teaching practices, and they do very well.
Yeah.
And in reality, probably make more money, if that's your goal in life, than someone who's touring with someone.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of these, you know, there's so many good players out there now. There's so many good players, and they're coming out of all of these colleges, and you know, they're 18, 19 years old,
yeah.
They can play their ass off, and they want a gig, and a lot of them will work for nothing. because, you know, and they're good enough. But if they can get their name on someone's CV, you know, I toured with Joe Bloggs, and Joe Bloggs happens to be a massive artist, then, you know, they work for PDs, they work for expenses.
Yeah.
And it goes on, and it always has done, and it always will do. It's not a great state, and it's not something that's, but it's just always there.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, talking to various people over the years about this, and I had a conversation, I'm sure you won't mind me saying, with Gavin Harrison the other day, and Porcupine Tree went to play, and I think it was India, he said. And countries like that, and various countries around the world, they don't try and hide the fact they do free downloads. It's kind of like, you know, they almost wear it on their T-shirts, you know.
Right.
I downloaded your album for nothing. Tough.
Right.
And it kind of, they did this gig over there to like 14,000 people, I think he said. And this is like in a 3,000-seater venue. So the tickets were like oversold 10 times over.
Yeah.
And he said there was 14,000 people singing their songs, and they hadn't sold like one album in India. It's just the way of the way it is. And as I say, it's not right, but it's not going to change, I don't think.
No.
And we can all piss and whinge and go on about, you know, someone owes me 5p for this and 10p for that, but it's not going to change. And I think sometimes, you know, you can lose sight of more important things, you know, than just chasing the dollar all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think if, you know, there's, without trying to sound like some old hippie, it's like health and happiness is, you know, pretty high up the agenda.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and I had a very difficult year last year. I lost a lot of close friends who actually passed on. I personally got divorced. And this year's been great, particularly the album and everything. But, you know, you kind of, it puts life into perspective. And I'm happy, I'm healthy, and, you know, what more could I want? My band's got an album out, and I've got my new dog called Bonzo.
Oh, very cool.
So, yes, and he's a black dog, eh? Black
dog. Oh, there we go.
There's a link there somewhere. Yeah, so now he's great. So, you know, I get to walk in. I live in a lovely part of the world, so I can, particularly the weather we're having at the moment, it's all sunny, so I can walk through the forests with him, and it's great, you know.
It's just a good time.
Listening to my new album on iTunes on my iPod.
Well, there we go. Available from all reputable music stores.
Yeah. Amazon, iTunes, wherever you like.
Wherever you like.
Yeah.
Well, one guy that I've never really been a fan, of course. As you know, I'm a bit of a heavy metal chap here.
You are.
But one guy that I've always thought seemed like an all right, genuine bloke, and that was Jason Donovan, because it's you were the backing band for Jason Donovan, is that right?
No, we supported Jason on tour.
Supported him, right, okay.
Yeah, but yeah, we did two months with him, I think, and he was, and I'm sure still is, a fantastic guy.
Oh, cool, nice one, because he seems like he was an all right bloke.
What you don't see with all of this, and I can only relate this to someone like David Beckham, who is obviously mega, mega star.
Yeah.
You know, all you get is like Beckham this, Beckham that. You know, you never see the David Beckham who gives a load of money to charity or helps some kid who can't walk and does all that.
Yeah.
Because it's not papers. Now, I can tell you for a fact, every concert that Jason ever did, he would go out before the gig, and there was all the disabled people in wheelchairs and people less fortunate than us, and he would go out, sign whatever, make time, and go and see all those people.
All right,
and then
cool.
He would make sure that the front, in front of all the security guards, all those people were sat. You never saw that.
Yeah.
So all the screaming girls and stuff, in front of that, and always in places. And he would always take the time to do all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And he was a total, total gent in that respect. And I actually went walking. Jason would always present himself with makeup whenever he was in that sort of situation. So he always looked at his best, you know.
Yeah.
We always looked shagged out because we were normally hungover from the night before. He always looked great. And but I remember walking around London with Jason and just me and him. And literally no one recognized him. Wow. Because he had no makeup on. He was just dressed in, you know, jeans and a T-shirt. And not one person actually come up and said, you know, or someone may have recognized him, I don't know, but no one came up in. But he wasn't playing the star, you know, he wasn't walking around with, like, neon lights saying, my name is Jason Donovan.
Yeah, come and check me out.
Yeah, so it was just, we just wandered around, I don't know, somewhere like Devon or something, you know, really normal. very un-rock and roll. Of course, I was probably drinking, like, Jack Daniels or something, you know. But, yeah, he's a lovely guy. Very, very nice, very genuine, and great guy to tour with. And he, at that time, he was huge. I mean, we were doing three nights at the NEC, then we did three nights at Aston Villa Leisure Centre, come down, do three nights at Wembley Arena, then you do three nights at Hammersmith. So he was big, big news back then, you know,
yeah,
massive news. That's so cool. It was good talk, good fun.
Well, see, another band that you toured with, and they would have to probably be, I mean, as a young kid, they were probably the first band that I got into, because my brother used to listen to them as well, and that was the Monkees. What was it like with those guys?
Well, they were great entertainers. They were fantastic entertainers. When we played with them, let's just say they probably weren't getting on at the best part of their career,
right,
with each other. They were kind of looking. they weren't getting on great. I'll leave it at that, Chris. They were kind of, you know, not best buddies at that time.
Okay.
But no, we did 59 days straight through with them. We were doing matinees at the Albert Hall as well.
Wow.
So, they were great. It was a great, I hate to use the word family show, but you know what I mean? It was just a great, entertaining show.
Yeah.
Then we did Richard Marx, and that was good. Mark Shulman, who was drumming with Richard at the time, a great guy, lovely, lovely guy.
Cool.
And just another little plug, I've got Mark Shulman in clinic at Absolute Music on July the 30th.
Oh, well, there we go.
So, but it'd be great to meet up with Mark again, because we got on really great. We'd spend the nights in the hotel rooms just kind of talking about all the stuff we listened to when we were kids, you know, all your Jeff Beccaro, Steve Gadd tracks, you know, just all the stuff we listened to growing up and all the influences. And we kind of both had the same sort of influences of those type of, I guess most people of the age of 25, like me, will have the same sort of influences. You know, I mean, Jeff is just a monster player.
Yeah.
It's really funny, because if I can just probably bore everyone to death with this bit, I started playing drums when I was 10 or 11, and I was quite a clever child prior to that. Hard to believe now, but I was quite an academic child, and it kind of went tits up. So I actually learned nothing at the age of 11. But I just discovered drumming, and a friend of mine was having lessons, and I was taught by this old trumpet player, and we just got on. It was literally metronome pad sticks, you know, and that was it for 6 months, you know, rudiments. But for me, it just became, I just became besotted with it. And I said, Mum, want a drum kit, Mum. Mum was like, well, if you want a drum kit, you get it yourself. And I lived in a small village in Dorset, and I did everything to get this drum kit. I sold holly at Christmas. I did penny for a guy. I did everything, you know. And Sir Navis, the village I lived in, was very full of, like, spinsters, old spinsters. And I did two paper rounds. They all knew what I was doing. And I'd go round on a Saturday, knock on their doors, and then they'd give me 50p to mess up their garden for them. And I saved up £100. And that was a lot of money, you know, 4 years ago when I was 21. So, and it was just, I bought this drum kit, and I found you didn't have the internet and stuff like that. So I went up to Bristol, which is about a, 120, 130 mile round trip for me from here.
Right.
And bought this drum kit for £110 from, like, a local paper. And Mum gave me the £10. And then I started playing in bands. And I have to say, everyone has this life-changing moment. And I discovered an album by Deep Purple called Machine Head. It was already out. And that was the point where I decided that drumming was great, school was shit, and I had to grow my hair long and have my ears pierced. And Ian Paice was just my first absolute hero in the drumming world. And I met him, and the guy's an absolute legend, beautiful man, lovely guy. Of course, that also went into John Bonham, Keith Moon, you know, those type of guys. And it wasn't until later, I was very lucky, I was playing a lot with a couple of older guys that were good players. And I bought a Ludwig when I was 15. And then I just went doing cabarets and doing function gigs and stuff like that, playing pro. And then when I was 21, I got taken in a band called Conundrum. That we were sponsored by Southwest Jazz, and which didn't mean we had any money, but it meant we could drink beer all day, smoke a lot of pot, and call ourselves professional jazz musicians, and, which was great at that age, 20, 21. And these guys were older than me, and they took me under their wing, and they started playing me like, I guess Billy Cobham was the one that crossed it over from, you know, your sort of Ian Paice, John Bonham type stuff, into, I started listening to Tony Williams and, you know, Art Blakey and Elvin Jones and people like that.
Oh, yeah.
From that came Steve Gadd, and Steve Gadd's probably been, since then, you know, my singular most biggest influence, I guess. And a fantastic job you did of interviewing Mr. Gadd as well the other night,
Chris. Oh, thank you very much.
Most enjoyable, sir.
You know,
and I feel deeply honoured to actually be on the same type of podcast that Mr. Gadd's been on.
Episode 59, Dr. Steve Gadd. Episode 60, Austin Lane.
And then another thing, just on a little vibe, I was looking at iTunes this evening, and we're on the, like, I don't know why we're in the heavy metal section, but we are.
Oh, cool, man.
Amazon, not iTunes, on the Amazon thing.
I told you to get into heavy metal, man.
And there we are. We're number 18 in the heavy metal chart, and Made in Japan by Deep Purple is number 19.
Nice.
I'm just beside myself. I never thought that I would be on the same page.
Yeah.
Okay, it's the iTunes heavy metal chart, but on the same page is Deep Purple and Ian Paice.
That's really cool.
And I was kind of, I get totally excited about these little things, you see, because I'm now very simple, because I had no education from the age of 11, because I discovered drumming, you see. So we blame drumming for everything.
Oh, yeah, man.
But then Steve Gadd just became like this whole, and Steve Gadd is just, Steve Gadd is Steve Gadd. He's a phenomenon, isn't he? The man's just a legend and a gentleman, as you discovered. I've had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of times, and every time, such a humble man.
Without doubt, just amazing guy.
I want to go on record here. The best album ever made, Chick Corea, The Mad Hatter, Steve Gadd on drums.
There we go.
Oh, actually, the second best, because the best one is Seven by Seven, playing on drums.
Which is available in all reputable music websites and stores.
Did I mention that, Chris?
I don't think you did.
If I did, I might just have got away with it, but I'm not sure if I did or not. So, but if I didn't, anyway, yes, it's 7x7. It's available from Can't Tell Records. No, it's available from Escape Music. It's available from Amazon. It's available on iTunes. So please, just to make a 25-year-old man happy, just please go and buy it, please. Do whatever, just get it, tell your friends you just heard this great interview with this lovely guy who's speaking to Chris Troy, who's also a lovely guy. We're talking about my dog Bonzo. And before we started running, we were talking about Chris's family and his young kids, and it's all nice. It's a nice place. Drummers are nice people, so just to support us drummers, go and buy my record, hey.
We're all lovely people, and I'd just like to thank my two beautiful daughters for not waking up, because it's currently, it's 10:15 at night. They've been fast asleep the whole time. I'm home alone with them, and I've actually been crossing every part of my anatomy that they won't wake up, and I'd have to stop the episode and edit it later. So thank you very much to my lovely daughters, and
thanks
for staying asleep.
Well, that's only because you played on the new Seven album.
Yeah, they drifted right through. They'll go right through the night.
Zonk. two minutes in, first drum intro, zonk, gone.
Oh, God. Well, I tell you what, it's almost time to wrap this up, but I have to ask you your favourite story from back in the day. You got to have a few cracking stories, surely.
My favourite would be the one that really sticks in my mind. Oh, dear, let me think. Is going on stage at the NEC, we were supporting Jason Donovan, and there's like about 25 million, okay, 15,000 screaming girls. Oh. And we're stood at the back on the ramp, ready to go up on the stage, and we're singing a cappella, obviously the old Dobie Gray song, Drift Away. And we're giving it, you know, give me the beat, boy, to save my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. That's why I play drums, by the way.
Right.
The other guys all had great voices, and they're all doing these super harmonies, and Nick's doing his vocal gymnastics over the top. And then the lights went down, and you suddenly had 15,000 screaming girls. And we got on, and Simon always started to set this keyboard intro, and it just built, and then I do this drum fill, and it came in, and that was just such an immense moment.
Wow.
The other one was when you first get... in the days of vinyl, guys, remember vinyl?
What's that?
We were on a radio station, and they played our single. It was the first time we'd actually seen the single.
Wow.
And that was a great feeling. And to bring it right up to date was Mick got some CD copies and put one in the post to me. And my birthday was the 16th of this month. And literally on the Saturday, my birthday was on the Monday, on the Saturday, our new CD arrived on the doorstep.
Wow.
And that was another one of those moments. And there's been so many. As I said to you earlier, I mean, I've been so, so lucky to, and I'm not talking about achievements, I'm just talking personally and, you know, just to continue. Now I make a living out of selling drums at Absolute Music. Prior to that, I was at Paul Percussion. I've met some great people. I've had some great times, and I've been lucky to be in a band with some great guys. And I was talking to Keith via Facebook messages. And when this all kicked off, sort of 6-8 months ago, before we started the recording process and doing things again, I said to Keith, I said, are we in a band again, mate? And he goes, it always have been, always will be. And as a band, and I think this applies to any band, not just Seven, when we were kind of in the early days trying to crack it, as I say, we went up and down this country in a van, staying in some of the worst places you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
And you're with these guys 24/7, and you kind of build up a bond that even when you fall out, that bond is sort of stronger than you'd probably ever have with anyone else.
Yeah.
I think that even goes to pub bands and whatever bands. And whenever you look at any band at whatever level you're at, any fallout is normally 99 times out of 100 from external sources. Whether that external source is a record company or a management or whatever, or it's, you know, my mate's girlfriend wants to come to practice or stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's not normally the 4, 5, 3, however many people in the band that cause those problems.
Yeah.
It's always someone outside. And I've just been very, very lucky. I've made the records I wanted to make. I've made a living out of playing drums. As I say, it's not in the biggest band in the world. Well, maybe we might be in this 12 months' time. This could be a different conversation.
Yeah, man.
And this as well, I mean, in doing an interview with you, you know, I mean, okay, we've known each other for a long time through when you were teaching, I was selling stuff. And obviously with your Supernova drums, you know.
Yeah.
So, but this is the first time we've ever sat and talked drums properly.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the first interview. I mean, I did loads of interviews. We all did back in the day. But they were all for, like, Girl Magazine. And it was like, well, what's your favourite colour, Oz? What's your favourite food, Oz? And it was never about drums. And this is just, this is like another box ticked. To be able to talk about drums, you know. And it's just, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, Chris. And it's been a great time talking to you. And a great pleasure to be number 60 after Mr. Steve Gadd's, Dr. Steve Gadd's 59. I can't thank you enough. And I'll catch up soon. And thank you very much.
Cool, man. Well, thanks a lot. It's been absolutely awesome catching up with you. And what is your favourite colour?
Yellow.
Yellow. Right. Okay. Cool. I should have started with that one. God damn it.
You should. Yeah.
Well, no. Honestly, thanks a lot, man. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you and just finding out more as well.
That's been great, Chris. And again, thank you ever so much for your time and for doing this. And once again, I don't think I've mentioned it, but if anyone out there just fancies buying a record, then make it 7x7. Hey, iTunes, Amazon, wherever you fancy. Okay.
Sorry, Matt. Have you got a record out?
No, I don't think I mentioned it. You go back to the beginning, because I'd like to mention. I just happened to have a new album out, mate. If you possibly,
is that right?
Could. Yeah, would you mind mentioning it at all? You know,
if
you speak to anyone in your daily sort of, you know, when you're making drums or doing whatever, just if you could just sort of say, by the way, mate of mine's got an album out. You know, that'd be kind of cool. That'd be nice.
All right. Yeah, we'll do that. No problems.
Cheers, Chris.
Cool, man. Thanks a lot. So there we go, fine listener. Another great episode for you. Please make a point of going to Amazon, iTunes, or a reputable music store and check out, you know, if you want to check it out, then go for it, man. But buy if you can. The number 7 album by 7. It's a really good album. It really is. I like it a lot. Downloaded it myself. So Austin is a great guy and he needs all the support that you could give him. So please also make sure you go to 7's fan page on Facebook by literally just searching at the top 7 fan page and it will take you to the right destination. But until next episode, friends, have fun, play your drums, and I'll see you later. Bye-bye! With no name.